Hey, welcome back to the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. We're helping the good people win the rhetoric wars. The good people, go away, bad people. We don't want you to win anymore. And unfortunately, they've won a lot, you know, as we've seen in the last 4 years in America. Complicated times out there. They require sophisticated techniques. So let's learn some rhetoric. What do you say? How's that sound? Tim, ready to learn some rhetoric?
I'm ready.
I'm Dr. Dan. Dr. Dan French, American rhetorician, escaped professor. I pulled the ripcord, left academics, late night comedy writer, founder of Rhetoric Warriors. I'm trying to get some of this academic heft, some of this bulk, and bring it over into the world and see if anybody wants to gnaw on it. And I do that in three ways. I talk to comedians about their politics, which is fun. I convert conservatives, which is also fun for me. And I talk to academics and people have interesting perspectives on all this stuff. So I would put this, my guest tonight, into that last category. We went to grad school together. I've pulled a few people out of my academic past for this. I don't know if you've watched any of that stuff, but a couple of guys I went to Texas with and it's been super fun catching up with them. My guest this week is Dr. Tim Simpson. And he is at the University of Macau. Is it University of Macau or Macau?
Yes, University of Macau.
University of Macau. And if you haven't heard of that, well, welcome to the West. because he's on the bottom corner of China, hanging out in an old Portuguese colony that's been handed back to China. And Tim's been handed back to China along with it. He's been there for a long time, does a lot of really interesting stuff on cultural space and rap music and consumption. Cultural studies guy, right?
Yes.
Exactly. Is that how you identify, how you self-identify?
Something like that, yeah.
All right, so everybody welcome Tim Simpson.
Thank you.
What's up?
Thank you. Not much. What's up with you?
I was going to wear the black shirt, but I figured like the glasses, the head, it was just going to be too much.
We're pretty much matching. You do have on a black shirt, actually.
I do. Well, it's a black hoodie. It's really falling apart.
Yeah, you look distinct now that you have a hoodie instead of a t-shirt. Otherwise, we look like identical twins.
Well, I just fought my way through, 8 days of Texas Siberia. So I may not take this off until it gets back up to 100.
Yeah, I'm wearing short pants.
So what, tell people, like, orient Macau a little bit. You oriented me before we started, but orient people to Macau and the University of Macau and your background just a little bit.
Sure. Macau was a Portuguese colony. It was one of the first Asian colonies one of the first European colonies in Asia, and it was the last European colony in Asia. So it was founded in 1557. By Portugal, and then Portugal handed it back to China in 1999, which was 2 years after Hong Kong went back to China. So for 450 years, it was a Portuguese territory right on the edge of China. And it's still a kind of semi-autonomous territory because—
Like wholly owned by Portugal that whole time?
Yeah, actually it has a very unique status because it was never clear exactly who owned it. And that was the benefit of Macau. It was a Portuguese colony, and there was an agreement between Portugal and China that it was administrated by Portugal. But it was sort of it was never really formalized. It was never written down. Mm-hmm. And for a while in the beginning, Portugal paid an annual fee to China in gold or silver. And that lasted for a while, and then they stopped doing that. And it was just sort of a very ambiguous, ill-defined place. Up through the 1970s, when Portugal, in 1973 or 74, 73, Portugal had their own Carnation Revolution, the coup that overthrew the fascist government in Portugal at the time, and they started to decolonize. They were the last European country that had colonies all over the world. And they had been fighting wars in Africa, trying to hold on to their colonies. And after 73, or 74, they decided to decolonize. and they started trying to give Macau back to China then. And it took a long time before China was ready to accept it. So it happened in 1999.
Really?
But it was always ambiguous all that time, which was the whole the benefit. Or Macau used that ambiguity to its benefit. So you could, both Portugal and China could do things in Macau that they couldn't do in either Portugal or China.
Oh, so like to avoid some law issues.
Exactly, yeah.
Was it like a, like Delaware, like corporate stuff and like finance, you know, squishiness like Switzerland or something?
No, it was more like Casablanca or something like that, you know. Huh. And it's, so in 1999, Portugal returned it to China. And then I came in 2001. 18
months
later.
Part of the package? Were you
included in the offer? Part of the agreement. Part of the agreement. China agreed to take Macau back as long as I came with it. So I was looking to relocate to Asia at the time. So I took a job here, and I just happened to start 18 months after the handover. And I really didn't know anything about Macau when I moved here. I knew vaguely what it was, but I had no real understanding of it.
Because you had started in Thailand and Hong Kong. That was your original connection to Asia.
Exactly. I was working at Ohio University, and Ohio U had a joint doctoral program in Thailand with Bangkok University. And they sent me to work there a couple of times. And then they also had a degree program in Hong Kong that they taught through a university there. And they sent me a couple of times to work in that. And so when I decided I wanted to move to Asia, I was actually looking for a job in Hong Kong. And I applied for a couple of jobs there. And then I just saw an ad for Macau, which I knew was somewhere in the vicinity of Hong Kong. But
right.
Beyond that, I didn't know anything about it. It's a 1-hour ferry ride from Hong Kong down the coast. So it was just fortunate that when I came here, and it ended up to be a cool place. But I didn't know. I thought I would come for 1 or 2 years and then move on, you know. But what happened here that's really interesting, Macau has always had legal gambling since the 19th century. Portugal legalized gambling.
Okay, good move for a colonist nation.
Exactly. And then, but it was a monopoly. The gambling industry was a monopoly, and the monopoly was owned for the last 40 years by a local billionaire businessman named Stanley Ho. And Macau was just this little small gambling place in Asia that everybody in Asia knew of, but it was very seedy and controlled by gangsters and everything. And it was a monopoly industry. So one guy was making all the profits. And when Macau was returned to China, they established a new local government because the Portuguese administration left. And the local government decided to break that monopoly and liberalize the gambling industry. So this happened right when I moved here. It was just happening because the 40-year monopoly expired in 2002. So in 2002, they allowed several new companies to come in, which included Wynn Resorts, Steve Wynn from Las Vegas.
Ah.
Sheldon Adelson, Las Vegas Sands, MGM, and company from Hong Kong, Galaxy, and another couple of companies. In the end, there ended up being 6 companies now that can operate casinos in Macau. And so everything just exploded as a result. And because Macau is sitting on the border of China, where there's, you know, 1.3 billion people who are avid gamblers, most of them, and there's no legal gambling in China. So the easiest place for Chinese people, tourists to come gamble is Macau. So immediately Macau, within a couple of years after those new companies came in and started building casinos, Macau became the biggest gambling spot in the world. And
wow,
you would be surprised to know this, that it's the most, by far, the most lucrative casino place in the world. And it's much, much more lucrative than Las Vegas, even though it's a tiny little city state, and it's really small. You would be, it's about 9 square miles, all of Macau.
Really?
It's three little interconnected islands right off the coast. And half of that space is reclaimed land. It's fake land that they've made to gradually expand the territory over the last 100 years. But it is the casino industry is much more lucrative than Las Vegas.
That's fascinating. That's James Bond level. Like I could see like, you know, all that great tradition of Asian gangster movies. Seems like somebody's got to write that script.
There's a whole subgenre of them set in Macau that again, if you were Chinese, you would know all about, but Americans have never heard of it. So James Bond himself came to Macau in the Man with the Golden Gun. If you remember that movie, he finds a bullet with a gold bullet with his 007 etched on it. And then he travels around Asia looking for the person who's trying to assassinate him or something like that. And he comes to Macau in that movie. And in the most recent James Bond movie with Daniel Craig, it starts off with him in Macau at a floating casino. I don't know if you remember, I forget which movie it is, but I think it's the very last one. It's the last one or the next to last one.
He was like a super spy and had sex with a lot of women and then killed people?
Yeah, I think that was the plot. You got it exactly. It was unique among all of the James Bond movies that have had that particular plot.
This one had sex and violence in it and tuxedos. Is that what you're saying?
Okay. Exactly, exactly. Right. Daniel Craig wore a tuxedo. It was that one, yes.
That one.
But interestingly enough, since you brought up James Bond, Ian Fleming himself, the author of the James Bond books, visited Macau one time. There was a newspaper in the UK who paid him to travel around the world and visit interesting cities. And he wrote a series of articles, and then they were collected into a book, which is called Thrilling Cities. And was published in the early 60s. And one chapter is about Macau. And in Macau, he talks about the gambling industry at the time and, you know, how interesting the city was. And he has a lunch with a guy named Pedro Lobo, who controlled the gold trade in Macau. And I need to explain that in a minute, what was the gold trade. But anyway, that guy became the inspiration for Goldfinger, the villain in the James Bond movies. It's a guy he met in Macau.
That's awesome. I swear it's like nobody really understands academics, but it's been so long since I just sat, you know, and triggered an academic to talk about things that they know. And it just flows. Like you have all these sub, you know, sub rivulets that you go into and all this sort of detailed, you know, trivia. I love it. I've always loved academic minds that have just been allowed to do what they do for a long time.
Normally they don't let me talk. So it'll all come out one time.
That's great. Now that's super interesting to.
And I should say, just to make one more point, in 2013 was the record setting year for Macau's casino revenue. And that year, 2013, it's gone down since then. But in 2013, the total revenue was 7 times more than Las Vegas.
Wow.
Macau casino revenue was 7 times greater than Las Vegas. So to give you some perspective on this place that most Americans don't even know anything about, it is kind of it's a sleeper kind of place, but it is interesting.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I've often argued that Americans, instead of paying taxes, we should be once a year or twice a year a paid trip to Las Vegas, and we have to gamble that amount. And that way you would at least have the excitement of a good weekend in Vegas or Atlantic City or something, and you would still lose the money. And every once in a while you would win the money, but you always lose the money. So that would be, you know, people wouldn't be so upset about paying their taxes.
And you've just described literally the way the economy of Macau is designed, because Macau has the most lucrative casino revenue in the world. and the government takes a 40%, 39% tax on that revenue. So Macau, again, here's another trivial fact. Just before COVID started, everything's changed in the last year, but before COVID, it was the second wealthiest territory in the world after Qatar in terms of per capita income. And the IMF, when the IMF designated it the second wealthiest, they said it will soon become the wealthiest place in the world. That's per capita income. There's about 650,000 people living here in Macau. It's also the most densely populated place in the world because it's so small. And 600,000 people living here, and there were 40 million tourists a year pre-COVID. So you can imagine.
Oh my God.
The quantity of people. And that year, 2013, the casino revenue was $45 billion. So the government took 40% of that in tax.
Yeah, see, sin and deviance, man. It pays. Yeah. What is wrong with all the conservatives in the world? Don't they see it pays? It's
exactly
fun.
Exactly. And you don't have to pay tax. They just encourage everybody to gamble, and that pays for everything. But actually, I'm not allowed to gamble because I'm a civil servant working at a public university. So really? we're not allowed to gamble except at Chinese New Year for 3 days. For 3 days at Chinese New Year, we're allowed in the casinos. Otherwise, we can't even go in the casinos.
That's amazing. Why would, and that's across the whole government and everything?
Yeah, all civil servants. That's a rule. I guess because they were concerned years ago that people would start gambling and they would borrow money because there's a lot of money lending and things like that. That's actually legal here. You can be a loan shark legally in Macau and loan people money to gamble. And I guess they were worried that people would lose money and get in debt, and then it would be easy to manipulate them into corruption or something. So they just made a blanket rule that nobody can go in the casino, which is good. The last thing I need to do, I mean, I could just walk out the, 5 minutes from my apartment and be in a casino. The last thing I need to do is be just gambling every afternoon, because I have nothing to do.
Yeah, I've done a bunch of stand-up gigs over the years that are in casinos, and so they put you up in a hotel in the casino and you eat in the casino and you do comedy that night in the casino. And it's like, well, what else are you going to do in the casino? You're going to spend the money you just made for the week in the casino.
It's a
very good recycling program that they've got built in. I've noticed, to bring the money back.
Exactly. Well,
that's really interesting. And what other people don't know is that you're originally from Alabama.
I am.
Right? It's not like you came from some urbane,
Hey. Huh?
Asia.
Let's end this conversation.
Huh?
I'm offended. Let's end the conversation.
Okay. Like, Asia was such, like, nobody saw that coming. You never had an Asia sub, strand in your research. That was just a coincidence of the job that you got at Ohio University.
Exactly. I had never been anywhere. I'm actually born in Atlanta and then grew up in Alabama, but my whole family was from Alabama. They just took my dad got transferred momentarily. I was born in Atlanta, then we moved right back to Alabama. So I grew up in Birmingham, Alabama, and my relatives were all in, my mom was from Andalusia, Alabama. My dad was from Gadsden, and my relatives were in Anniston. So those are the places I spent time, Florala, on the Florida-Alabama line. That's where I spent all my time growing up. And then I went to school at Auburn University in Alabama. And then graduate school in Arkansas, and then
that's
Florida.
Right. I remember.
Yeah. In Arkansas, I happened to meet Bill Clinton. That was the highlight of my time there. Before, just when he was launching his presidential campaign. I'm sure he remembers shaking my hand there.
That's where it all started. Like, you'd have been his intern.
But I had spent my whole life in the South, basically. And I had barely been anywhere. I had been to Canada one time. My parents on a summer vacation, we drove up to to Montreal, and that was pretty much it for my traveling. And I had, most of our vacations were in Florida, in like Panama City or Fort Walton, you know, the redneck part of Florida.
Yeah, it's just Alabama on the coast.
Exactly. So, yeah, it was, and when I finished, in, you and I were in school together in Tampa, and when I finished there, which I really loved Tampa, actually, it's not really the South. It was its own weird.
Yeah, it is. It's a Macau of Florida.
Yeah, exactly. Right? Exactly.
It has Spanish influence, Cuban influence.
It really does. The neighborhood I live here right now, which is very Portuguese, just the old Portuguese part of the city, looks exactly like Ybor City, okay, where I lived in Tampa. Same architecture, the same vibe and everything. So yeah, it does have that similarity. But I just happened to get that my first job at Ohio University. And the reason I went there was that was the only job that I got. It's a great school. It was a great job. I really liked the people. It was a very nice town. So I can't say anything. I don't mean to say anything bad about it. It was, I was happy to have that job. But right after I started working there, they had started this program in Thailand. And they asked me, actually during the job interview, if we hired you, would you be interested to go work at Bangkok University? And I said, sure, because what else are you going to say?
I'll take your job, but.
And then when I went there, I got the job. Immediately when I started, the department head said, so you're still interested to go to Bangkok University, right? And I said, okay. And then a few months later, she said something else about it. And then I said, well, what's the likelihood? What's the percentage likelihood that I'll go there? She said, oh, it's 100%. You're already going. We have to send somebody there and nobody else wants to go. And then I panicked. I was like, oh my God, I'm going to move to Thailand for 6 months. I've never been, you know, I don't even know what that is. So, but anyway, it just turned out to be a great experience. And I did it once. I really loved it. It took a while. It was hard to sort of figure it out because I went there just totally by myself. No language training, never had the food before. In Bangkok, if you can imagine, is like, you know, 15 million people city. So then somebody meets you at the airport. My flight got in at midnight, my first time to ever travel internationally. So I never had jet lag before. That was my first experience with jet lag. So somebody met me at midnight at the airport and drove me into the middle of the city and dropped me off at a condo where I was going to stay. And I remember thinking, I'm feeling really tired. I'm just going to lie down on the floor for a minute. And then I woke up the next day, I'm laying on the kitchen floor of this condo. And I was like,
welcome to Thailand.
Exactly. Looking around for something to eat. I'm in a completely empty condo with like two suitcases. And then I had to just walk outside and try to figure it out. You know, how do you eat here? How does the money work? What is the money? You know? So
like a lead student or anything like a.
They did. They didn't initially, but yes, they were extremely nice. And once the first thing I had to figure out was where's the university? Because I knew that the condo we were staying in was near the university, but I didn't know exactly where it was. And you couldn't see it. You couldn't walk outside and see it, but it wasn't far away. But my first attempt to find it, I knew it was down the street, but I went the wrong direction. And I walked for like 2 hours, all dressed up in like 100 degree heat, thinking, what is it going to be like this every day? And then I realized I was going the wrong way. Anyway, once I found it, then they were super nice and people were helping me, taking me everywhere and, you know, and helping me settle in. So it turned into a great experience, but it was definitely a big learning curve. And then I went back to Ohio at the end of that thinking, wow, that was a great opportunity. I'll probably never get to do that again. And a couple of months later, the department head said, is there any way we could talk you into going back to Thailand again? So anyway, and we also had that program in Hong Kong, which was much different. That was Ohio University offered a degree, a full undergraduate degree to students in Hong Kong. So they could take courses in Hong Kong and get an Ohio U degree without ever going to Ohio. Although a lot of them went there for one semester, one quarter.
And was that international students or was that, you know?
That was all Hong Kong students. In Thailand, the students were all Thai. There was maybe one or two from Malaysia, but they were all regional students. They would take a year of courses in Thailand and then they would all go to Ohio for 1 year. Then they would go back to Thailand and write their dissertation. And the Hong Kong students were undergraduate students. So they were just getting a degree. And Ohio U would send staff over like me to do these 1 month intensive teaching things where we would teach two classes for 1 month. And then otherwise they were hiring people in Hong Kong to teach the Ohio U classes.
That's bizarre. Like what was the appeal to the department to want to do that? What's the incentive?
We got the Hong Kong program was very popular for staff to teach in because you went over for 1 month and it was during, at Ohio U at the time we were on the quarter system. So we got out at the quarter ended at Thanksgiving and then we were out until January. So there was a 5 week break between Thanksgiving and New Year's. So you could go to Hong Kong for 1 month in that period and you didn't miss anything in Ohio because you were on break and you got extra pay and you got a 1 month for a free trip, you know, and you had your transportation was paid for, your hotel for 1 month in Hong Kong was paid for, and you got an extra month's salary, something like that. So that was a fun thing to do. And you could go either around Christmas or in the summer. So it was set up so that it didn't interfere with the regular teaching. And I think it was an opportunity for staff. I think it generated money for the university because those students in Hong Kong were paying tuition. And I guess they had it set up so that after they paid for all the staff and everything, they still made a profit off of it somehow. And it was good international, you know, relationship yep. and everything. And the one in Thailand, it was harder to get. Hello?
Yeah, I'm just here.
Okay. The program in Thailand was harder to get staff to agree to go because you had to go for a semester. And I was a single, relatively young, single guy. So I was happy to take a semester off from Athens, Ohio, rural Ohio, and go live in Thailand. But a lot of people, if you had family and kids in school and stuff, you didn't want to just leave for 5 months.
Sure.
And people they couldn't conceptualize what Thailand was if they had never been there. So they didn't know Bangkok is this modern city with every luxury convenience and everything, you know. They just imagined it was some kind of third world country. People were wrong, but that's what they imagined, you know. So the benefit, I think, for Ohio U was, you know, they had these international programs, relationships. They probably profited off of them, although I never really delved into, you know, the finances of them and things like that.
So you're a cultural studies guy. That's got to be the difference of educating those different those populations. Like I told you before we got on, I taught for a while at Peace College and all female Presbyterian, used to be a, you know, a hospital in the Civil War, basically Confederate, you know, school. And I came in, you know, as me and they were them. And there was this
big
massive
problem.
Culture.
Big problem.
Big problem. Massive culture clash. Like, and I ran the newspaper, which was a bad idea because I let them say whatever they wanted to say. And it just created this uproar and it was just constant furor over me. And, you know, so I know what it's like to sort of go into a culture like that where I don't fit. What was it like going into, you know, that kind of Thailand, Hong Kong, Macau? Like, what is the Asian educational, you know, relationship between the professor and the student and the educational flow? It's got to be completely different.
Completely different. Yeah. At Ohio University, students pretty much had the idea that the student and the professor were pretty much equal on the same level. And they could pretty much say whatever they wanted, which was fine. I sort of encouraged that there. I came up through the same system. So people had no problem to tell me I was wrong or argue about their grades and things like that. And in the US, you know, you've had a lot of experience with students in the US.
What? Like, who? No, argue grades? No, they're not.
Basically, American students are pretty much like Americans, you know. They don't change when they get in the classroom.
No, they get worse. Yeah.
And they get, yeah, they often get entitled and they're absolutely sure they didn't deserve a B on that exam because they're above average. Everybody, my roommate got an A. I don't see how I could have gotten a B. You have those kind of conversations.
Clearly the fault, they found where the fault lies. Exactly. And it's not in them. Yes.
But, and there's absolutely none of that teaching in Asia. Thailand, Hong Kong, and Macau are each very different from each other. Hong Kong and Macau have a lot of similarities, but they're still different kind of places. The British and Portuguese influence, respectively, has led to kind of a different kind of universities in both places. But and Thailand's totally different. But the three of them have a lot in common when you compare them to America. It's very different. And people don't speak up in class nearly so much. It's really hard to get students to talk. They're never going to argue with or disagree with a professor because their whole life, all through their education, they've had it hammered into them that, you know, you don't do that. And people don't argue about grades and things like that. It's very different. But that's easy to get used to. It's nice, you know.
Yeah, I would think that's not a, I would not, yeah. We need more of that.
What's difficult is adapting your teaching so that it makes sense to the students in the new place. So when I was in the US, over the years I developed, you know, we all have our standard lectures and examples and things we know we can fall back on, show this video clip, and you can have a class around that to teach some idea. And when I got here, I immediately realized none of that was going to work. You know, you can't show like a Seinfeld episode clip and then use that as a basis for a lecture because nobody's heard of that and it's not funny to them either. And everything I had used, I immediately realized none of it worked. So I had to just start over. And at first, it took me a while to sort of get to know the students, let's say in Macau, well enough to know what they did, what they were interested in, and, you know, what kind of music do they listen to, what pop culture are they interested in. And, you know, I was a pop culture focused person, popular culture focused person in the US. And I still don't know anything about Hong Kong sitcoms or stuff like that, you know, that people would see here, Chinese game shows, because I can't really understand them.
Right. Yeah. You can't access at that level of, like, especially at that level of communication. I did a stand-up show once at Hollywood Improv where they had bust in 200 Japanese teens on tour of the US and they're all like 14 and 15 years old. And they served them cake and ice cream, literally at the, you know, as part of the comedy show. You talk about, I mean, what do you got? They stared harder than anybody has ever stared. 400 eyes, 200 sets of eyes just going, you know, I'm just riveted, but they didn't. Yeah, it was bad.
Did you do your cow impressions?
I probably should have. Maybe that would have.
That might have worked.
They might have gone, well, he's acting like a cow. That's probably funny.
Yeah, so it's been a huge adjustment. And even I've been here 20 years at the University of Macau, but I worked for 4 years as a department head and then for 12 years as associate dean in my faculty. So I started doing a lot of administrative work and I was doing less teaching as a result. So I was still teaching every semester, but I was teaching a lot of graduate classes and things like that. So when all my administrative stuff ended about a year and a half ago, I went back to just being a regular full-time professor. And I was assigned to teach a class I'd never taught before, which is actually Introduction to Cultural Studies is what the class is. But to second year students, so students who are like 18 or 19 years old, just starting. And I hadn't taught students that young here in Macau for like 10 years. I had taught them when I first came, but I had gotten sidetracked doing this administrative work. And then since then, the generation gap that's increased in the last 10 years was another hurdle to overcome. And it was a disaster the first time I tried to do it. Even the stuff I had worked up in my experience here that did work in class, none of it worked again.
Yeah.
And the students they just had no idea what I was talking about anything. And I felt like I really had to start over.
And people don't understand that, you know, about teaching, the communication load, the translation load, you know, for every new class that comes in, like I said, every new generation, and what pop culture everywhere turns over in what, 2 years now?
Right, exactly. You know?
And you can't teach without examples. You just can't do it. And if you don't share the examples, what do you do?
Right, exactly. And you have one, you know of something that works. And like you say, in 2 years, that band that everybody thought was so great, 2 years later, they've never even heard of it. It's not that they don't like them. They don't even know who that is. And you just sound like some old guy even bringing it up, you know? They might look on their phone. What's he talking about? Oh, my God. My parents listen to them.
So give me an example of something that, like, would work now. Like, what do you – give me something that you could pull out of your golf bag right now and, you know, make sure it's gonna connect.
K-pop is really big right now. Everybody in Asia loves K-pop. So if you can say anything about Korean K-pop boy bands or something like that, people are riveted. They immediately know what you're talking about. If I ask them who's a good band, most people won't say anything. They'll just be silence. But the one outspoken person will say Blackpink, which is some K-pop band. And I vaguely know who that is. But if I put a picture of some Korean boy band up there, people will listen to what I'm saying. And I try to work that into the conversation.
That's fascinating. I was at a party one night and they were playing K-pop. It was just somebody who got interested in it through somebody in a subculture here in Austin and she knew it really well. She knew all the, you know, groups and it's just fascinating to watch the way that they repurpose, you know, American stuff and, you know, and you know, that kind of rave on cocaine. Like it's just that amazingness of visuals.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. And, you know, I was always interested in rap music. You mentioned that when we started. And I hadn't talked about that in years, but I started getting back into hip hop culture, not rap music itself, but just things like graffiti, because that's really popular here again. And so that kind of stuff, people, not everybody likes it, but people can kind of identify with it because there are graffiti artists in Macau, you know. I just noticed somebody painted their name on my apartment building the other day. So
was it you, Tim? It was you, wasn't it? can come out. You can, you're the Banksy of Macau.
Exactly. Yeah. So that kind of stuff.
Would they like something like that? Like Exit Through the Gift Shop, you know, the Banksy documentary, would they be able to, you know, at least relate to something like that?
Probably, but I haven't even seen that myself. I need to watch that.
It's great. It's really interesting.
I've heard the title, but.
Because he repurposes, like he turns the documentary around on the documentarian, you know, like about two thirds of the way through, you realize, oh, Banksy is now in charge of this documentary. it's pretty cool.
So, yeah. So anyway, I'm adapting, but I'm having to repurpose a lot of stuff. But I have managed to go back and pull some old things out. And I mentioned Seinfeld before. I actually did use the close talker bit from one Seinfeld episode. And people even laughed at that, even though they don't know who Seinfeld is. everybody can get the humor of the close talker.
Have you like in your own personal life, are you still accessing like your old culture, like American pop culture, or have you moved over and like, can you enjoy the aesthetic of, you know, Asian pop culture? Like, is that part of your life now, or is it just part of your academics?
Both. I mean, when you live in a new place, you gradually have to kind of adapt to what's going on there. But a lot of it I can't understand because I just can't speak the language. Even if I can understand a little bit, it's such a tiny bit that there's no way, you know, you couldn't get any nuances. And I don't even want to oversell it. I don't speak Chinese. So, and I certainly don't read it. You know, I can get in the taxi and tell the guy where I want to go, but that's about it. So there's a lot I can't understand. Although, you know, you have subtitled movies and things like that.
I'll send you a link to a buddy of mine, Bent Washburn, who really interesting comic. He's a failed Mormon. And so he has talked about that, but he's super intellectual so much, but he likes to go in and, you know, excavate a culture when he talks about it. And he moved to Stuttgart for 3 years with his wife, who was in the Air Force. And he was a stay-at-home dad in Stuttgart. And he talked about, you know, everybody was like, you'll learn the language. He goes, no, I never learned the language. What I learned was how to speak German with a really, or how to speak English with a strong German accent. And he does a thing about China, about trying to learn Chinese. And it's just, you know, fascinating to watch a comic who's a thinker go into a really extreme cultural experience and it filter back through stand-up.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought I would learn Chinese too. I first went to Thailand and I did take a lot of Thai classes and I did learn, you know, reasonably well. I learned enough Thai to sort of have simple conversations with people. And then I came here and it's just starting all over again. In America, people sort of assume, well, Thai and Cantonese must be pretty much similar, right? No, they're completely different scripts. They're not even in the same language family, you know? It's not like Spanish and English, you know, or German and Dutch. It's like Russian and English, you know?
people don't think about that very often, but you know, the prevalence of English in America, you know, you can get dialects and things like that, but you can still communicate from every corner to every corner. And that's pretty unique and for countries, isn't it? I mean,
it is. Yeah. China, in Macau and Hong Kong, the local language dialect is Cantonese, but it's not even really a dialect. It's just a different language. And in China, they have the standard language, Mandarin or Putonghua, which is kind of a language that they created to unite the whole country. But there's still dozens and dozens of regional dialects, which are impenetrable to each other. They use the same Chinese script, but they're each a completely different language. And Cantonese and Mandarin are, even you don't speak them, you can immediately hear that they're completely different languages. And that's been a big challenge at our university because we have a lot of local students from Macau. Because we're a public university, 80% of the undergraduates have to be from Macau. But then the other 20% are primarily from mainland China, although there's some from former Portuguese colonies around the world as well. But the students coming from China, most of them don't speak Cantonese. And so trying to adapt, even for Chinese speakers, it's an English language university, so the classes are primarily taught in English. But in everyday life, there are multiple languages being used all at the same time. And actually, Portuguese is still an official language of Macau.
Oh, so really?
Portuguese and Chinese are the two official languages. And then the university operates in English. But that means if you go to a meeting, you're going to hear like four different languages spoken at the same time. And that's how everything is. My contract is written in Portuguese.
Really?
Because it's not legal to have the contract in English because English isn't an official language. So they give you like an unofficial document that you can use to kind of translate by yourself what you think your contract says. So yeah, it, it's true. The U.S. is very is unique in that you can travel around and pretty much understand people everywhere, even though they might have a funny accent. You mentioned earlier. Go ahead. Sorry.
I was just going to say, I think that's one of the things about, you know, when people, when you go, like my daughter's in France for her senior year of college. And
yeah,
you know, she left from the University of North Texas in Denton, Texas, you know, and now she's in France and, you know, she's already got a friend who's Irish and, you know, all these different things. And she's having to deal with all that. Americans get frustrated with it because we don't have to do it. You know, like you put a little bit of it in front of us, like, this is too much, you know?
Exactly.
But like, listening to your experience, the amount of adaptation you've had to do is enormous.
Yeah, it's crazy. And you get comfortable not knowing what people are saying, right? Mm-hmm. When they're right there and you know, often they're switching to another language so they can say something about you that they don't want you to hear. But there's an advantage. You know, I go to the coffee shop and I can read and concentrate really well, even though there's conversations going on around me, because I can't understand what they're saying. So I'm not eavesdropping. I go to the U.S. and I try to do that. I was in New York on sabbatical trying to work in coffee shops, and I'm constantly listening to these crazy conversations that are happening all around me. You just can't help but eavesdrop, you know? So in some ways, there's a benefit to not really knowing what people are saying, you know?
Well, and I think that training is really, it is powerful. And, you know, I did enough cultural studies in my program to get a taste of what it means to go across into new cultures that you know nothing about and turning that into a positive experience. And that's why, like when I was teaching in the South, or, you know, I taught in California and Florida and all these different places, you get to where you enjoy like all that adaptation. You know, it's not an annoyance. It's part of the pleasure of the experience.
Exactly.
And just Americans don't have that very much.
You know what, you mentioned earlier that I'm from Alabama, and then you were asking what do I use in my classes? And I started using that, the fact that I'm from Alabama, and actually telling my students at the very beginning, showing them what Alabama is and showing them American, typical American attitudes towards Alabama, and showing them I found a whole string of newspaper articles, newspaper headlines, that's Alabama is the worst place, the worst state for this, the second worst state for that, and just trying to give them a picture of where I come from and making that part of my identity. And I noticed when I first moved here, not even when I first moved here, but just living here, when I meet Americans in Asia, they always ask me where I'm from. You know, that's the first question. And I always say, I'm from the U.S. And they say, I know that, but where in the U.S.? And I say, Alabama. Then there's always this long pause. They just look at me and then they say, everybody says exactly the same three things. They say, I don't think I've ever met anybody from Alabama before. And then they say, how come you don't sound like you're from Alabama? And then they say, how did you get out of there? That's exactly the...
Yeah. That's right.
That's exactly the experience. And I realize I should just tell that to the students so that they, you know, they have a different idea about who I am. And they're not used to seeing a teacher sort of being self-deprecating about something like that. You know, I'm from the second worst state in America after Mississippi.
Yeah, that's, you know, classic stand-up technique, man. Take yourself down and then you can take everybody else down. And I'm from Kentucky. So the only thing
Even
that
worse.
Adds into those three statements is, I drove through Kentucky once. It's gorgeous. You know, and I'm like, yeah, but your family didn't stay there for seven generations, did they? You
know? And by the way,
I used to do stand up in Alberta once a year. And I would tell people at the beginning of the show, I'd be like, well, I'm from Kentucky, and they would laugh. And I'm like, that's how you know your state is too redneck, when other countries know to laugh at your specific state. So thanks for that.
And I should say, just to be clear, I love Alabama. I'm just
sure,
joking.
I love Kentucky.
And Birmingham has turned into one of the coolest cities in America. When I go back there now, I just can't believe how hip it is. The downtown area where my dad worked, you know, the north side, which used to be like, you don't get out of the car when you're driving through here, it was so dangerous. It's now like super hip with all kinds of cool bars and restaurants, you know, internationally rated chefs and stuff like that, you know, so.
I think it's interesting what's happened to the South with hipness, you know, the way that it's merged. Like if you look at Atlanta, you look at Nashville right now, you know, all those states, you had this merger between that kind of hipness and the sort of retro, you know, hillbilly culture and, you know, all that stuff that they've gone in and colonized it from the center out. But there's all those states are kind of cool. I mean, all those cities are kind of cool now.
Yeah. It became the new place to be. The downtown is gentrified and the hipsters have moved in, but it's become a really cool, there's a cool vibe in Birmingham. So I'm happy to go back there now. I wish, you know, the only problem is this past year I've been stuck in Macau. By the way, Macau, I think, is probably the safest place in the world to be during COVID because we're this little self-contained island city that you can't get into. You have to, anybody who wants to come in has to cross through customs. So you can control exactly who comes in and out. So they just shut down the borders basically. And we don't have any COVID cases here.
Do you have an economy? I mean, how do you have an economy without?
That's the problem. Nobody's making money. The casinos aren't making any money because it depends entirely on those 40 million tourists a year. But fortunately, because they made a lot of money, they have a lot. The government has a lot in the bank, you know. But I think people are starting to panic because you have to wonder, is this mass tourism sort of phenomenon, is it over now?
Right.
You know, are we ever going to go back to how it was before? So anyway, I didn't mean to move us back to this topic of conversation, but I appreciate Alabama more and more each time I go back there. So,
well, I think it is one of those things, you know, the South is one of the areas in America that's resisted, you know, mellowification and homogenization, you know, fairly well for a long time. So at least has the premise of culture there, and you can adjust it away from some of the ugliness of that culture and sort of the, you know, stuck in the pastness of that culture, but it still likes culture. It still likes crazy people. It still likes, you know, insane, you know, ideas and, you know, stuff like that. So in some ways the South has an energy that the rest of America doesn't always have.
Yeah, that's true. And let me ask you a question. Are you still doing stand-up?
I stopped doing stand-up when I moved to LA and became a full-time TV writer. And I still always wrote for stand-ups, but there's just no way to really, you know, compete out in LA. There's so many stand-ups. And I had no desire to go and wait for stage time with 40 other people, you know. And I would still do gigs. I would still do maybe 3 or 4 gigs at comedy clubs over the years that liked me and that would just bring me in. But stand-up is very, you know, turnstile. So people would leave the club would go out of business, and the new people come in and didn't know me. So eventually all the places I could work easy went away. So I'm like, okay, I guess I'll just, I'll do other things. And I started doing one person shows instead of straight stand-up, where I take a concept and I stand-upize it. You know, I go in and do full joke work on it to turn basically every line that I can into a joke. And then I have like an hour and a half show on a topic. So it's still stand up, but you can't go do that in clubs because they don't want to hear. I did the weight loss show where I lost 100 pounds and I would do that in comedy clubs, but it's a bunch of fat jokes, which work even with fat people if you're done right.
Because when I think back on Tampa, I remember going to the comedy club there with you when you were the MC. And I spent a lot of time. And how long ago was that? That was like more than 25 years ago.
I left in 94. So that was 92 to 94.
Yeah. And I remember thinking back on the comedians that I saw because you were getting me in free. I was just going there, and you were we didn't have any money as graduate students. So it was a big appeal to get in there free. And
yeah,
but you were the MC, and I knew you as the acerbic guy in everyday life, but as an MC on stage, you had a kind of different persona. You were much more like the woo-hoo
kind of. How you doing?
And, but I was thinking about the comedians I saw at that comedy club when I was going with you, like Ellen DeGeneres was one of the funniest people at the time.
Yeah, she was awesome.
Rich Jenny, I think.
Yeah.
Remember him? And do you remember Andy Kindler?
Sure. I was talking about Andy Kindler on an earlier podcast today.
Yeah, he was, I think, the single funniest person I saw the whole time that we were there. And you told me, like, the set the night before, he like walked off stage halfway through because nobody was laughing.
Yeah, and that's my next story I told today. I was like, if Andy's energy was 10% off, the audience wasn't buying it. But if he was completely on, funniest human being ever, like everything he says, every attitude, all of it, it's like, you know, I always love that joke he did that week about, hey, you know, I know I'm not doing that well, but the club's doing a Andy Kindler sandwich special. It's not very good, but you get to eat it for 45 minutes. You know, great, great comic. But yeah, like if his energy was a little off, man, people would just be like, I don't get it. I'm walking.
Do you remember a guy, not to delve too far back, and maybe this is too obscure, but there was a guy who was really tall and thin with red hair and a mustache, and he just sort of, he was just ad-libbing the whole set. He was really funny also. You told me like you watched several sets and like 75% of the jokes were new each time. He was just talking to the crowd.
Matt, I think that may have been Matt Berry. He was
That sounds right. Yeah, yeah.
From Denver. He went on to be a big time showrunner in LA. He ran Desperate Housewives for a while.
Oh wow.
Yeah. And was a very successful executive producer in Los Angeles.
Wow, that's interesting. But I remember him. He sticks out in my mind as being really funny also.
Yeah, he was great. He would walk out. His opening line was, he'd walk out on stage and he'd be like, I've been playing a lot of stadiums. Mostly, lately, it's been stadiums.
That actually sounds like the guy I remember. Yeah.
Yeah, he was great. Well, that club was owned out of Denver, so a lot of the Denver comics who were just an awesome comedy scene, a lot of them became really popular, you know, writers and professional comics, and they would just send them all down there, you know, as part of a run from Denver. So it was a great club.
Yeah, interesting. Well, I haven't been back. I tell you, that's something that does. I mean, I haven't been back to comedy clubs. I don't think since I left there. I don't know that I've ever been to another one. And that's something that doesn't translate very well cross-culturally. You try to go to watch a stand-up comic here, it's just, even if you understood the jokes, they wouldn't be funny, you know.
Yeah.
In Thailand, there's a by the way, my wife is Thai. I married somebody from Thailand, so I spend a lot of time there too. And I learned that there is a whole genre of Thai stand-up, but it's not it involves multiple people, and it's really slapstick.
Yeah.
And there's always like a guy dressed up as a woman, and there's, you know, sometimes a dwarf or a midget or something, and then there's a lot of slapstick and a lot of sound effects and stuff, but it's very popular genre of comedy. And I made the mistake one time when I was in Bangkok of somebody taking me to one of those places. And if you're the only foreigner in the crowd, every joke is at your expense and you have no idea what anybody's talking about. It's very, very awkward. So
I would have enjoyed watching that part of it. Yeah.
And even regular Thai stand-up, there's one really successful Thai stand-up comedian, stand-up comic. And my wife is often showing me his routine and then translating why it's so funny, but it's just not funny, you know?
Yeah.
No matter how you explain it, it's not that I don't understand it. It's just not, the jokes aren't funny if you're not Thai.
It's very odd, especially in stand-up, because stand-up is so reliant on, you know, nuances of verbals and, you know, being able to know the culture at its intricacy so you can sort of pull those out and the absurdities and all that stuff. And it just doesn't go across cultures at all. Like Netflix loves to buy, apparently they must pay like $50 for them because they love to buy international stand-ups, pre-made specials, and then just put them on. And they're never funny. There was a guy from France who talked about moving here and how popular he was in France and how everybody hates that. Him here.
The guy who made the show, huge in France.
Yeah. He was France's most popular stand-up. His name's Gad something.
Yeah, yeah.
And he learned English and did the show in English, and he still wasn't funny.
Yeah, I watched the series, the whole, however many episodes it was. I watched the whole thing. You're right. He wasn't funny, but the only thing funny was that he kept showing people how popular he was in France.
Yeah.
He showed everybody the video on his phone of how the huge reception he got in France. The only thing I thought funny about that show was that there was a weird part of the story about his son. He went back, he came to America to try to get back in touch with his son, his relationship with his son. Did you watch it?
I don't think I watched the whole thing. I watched the first one and then I'm like, yeah, I don't think I can watch this guy.
Well, his son wants to be a model. He's training to be a model. And he has his ex-wife has a new partner who's trying to, her boyfriend or husband or whatever is trying to help the son be a model. And he wants to get breast implants to build up his pecs. And that becomes a motif of the story, which is so weird. That part of it was funny. You could never quite tell. Is it supposed to be funny or is it supposed to be serious? Or
right. You know,
that part worked somehow because it was so weird, but the rest of it, yeah, it wasn't very funny. You're right. That guy's not very funny.
Well, and I was writing at the Late Late Show when Craig Ferguson took over, and I've never found a single word that guy said funny. But I left pretty soon after that, went and wrote at Dennis Miller, but a buddy of mine was there for almost the entire run that Ferguson was there. And I went back and watched the show a couple of times. At one point he had like the two guys dressed up in a dancing horse costume and puppets. And I'm like, what happened here? Like, this is devastating. You know, it's just not funny. Not funny. But American stand-up is very particular and it's not done like that anywhere else in the world. There's a guy, Ronnie Chang, who's a Chinese comedian. Have you seen that? He had a special here and I think he is Chinese, but he speaks pretty good English. So he may be Americanized somehow, but he does this whole show in a tuxedo and I'm watching it and it echoes or mimics American stand-up, but it doesn't get there.
I've seen the Chinese comedian Joe something.
Joe Coy?
No. In fact, I've used one of his bits in class here because he was invited to speak to the correspondents' dinner or something that they have in Washington, D.C. every year. And when Joe Biden was vice president during the Obama administration, and he gets up on stage and says, I'm from China, you know, I moved to America. I can't believe I'm on stage with the vice president of the United States. And he says that, you know, I read your book, I read your autobiography, and now I'm talking to you face to face. And I think the book was much better. Which is pretty funny. It's not funny when I say it, but it's a pretty funny joke.
Like a joke.
But it's so crazy for Chinese people to see a Chinese immigrant in America saying that to the vice president. I mean, that blows people's minds that you could do that. You know, you could poke fun at somebody like that in a public setting. So that's very popular. I started using that in the last semester, actually, in class. To illustrate some academic point. But I forget his last name. I think it's Joe Wong or something like that. He's probably pretty dated now. I mean, that you know, when was Biden vice president? It was a while back. So
it was a little unfortunately a while back. Yeah, it's fascinating to watch, you know, that stuff, the way it doesn't go across cultures, and it doesn't even go across cultures in America. Like, that's one of the problems now with trying to do stand up is the political, you know, broke out, like the pinata got broken. And so now the political is in everything, and Americans have never liked that. But now they're all activated and they can't turn it off. So anytime you mention somebody from their side, they get triggered.
Yeah. I'm sure.
Like, no, this is comedy. Like, the rules here are I get to say whatever I want and you just sit there, but they can't do it anymore. They can't not participate. We have too much participative democracy in America.
Yeah. It's crazy. It's disturbing for sure. And I'm not even there, but it's disturbing watching it from here. So I can only imagine. Yeah. You can't cross tribes basically in poking fun at something, because you're just going to anger everybody
You can do it, but it just takes a very sophisticated type of scripting. There's some comics that do it. And like, I have a political show where I walk out, and again, with COVID and everything, I haven't really been able to do it, but I used to rent theaters here in Austin, and I would go and do these one person shows. And I have one about politics, and I walk out, I'm like, I'm going to do an hour or an hour and a half of politics tonight. So get ready, you know, because that's all you're going to hear is politics, but I'm not going to offend anybody. That's my promise, because I agree with everybody. I agree with every perspective. And then I start into, you know, I ask who's a conservative. I'm like, do you think they should build a wall? I said, how tall should it be? I'm going for 100 feet, like 100-foot wall. And I think, you know, you should be able, if you want to, like, you should, you know, there'd be cameras on it. And so, like, you can go and drop things on people who are trying to come over the wall, and we can make it a game show. You know, can you get up the wall? And you just blow it out, you know, amplify it to the point where they see, like, yeah, there's no justification for what you believe, but I've outbelieved you on your bad belief. And you can do it any, you know, both sides. You can do it to either side. The liberals, like, I do a joke about, here's how liberal I am. I married a man, you know. That's how down I am with the gay movement. I'm a straight man who married a straight man, because I didn't want to take a gay man, you know, off, and we're going to stay married, by God.
You know, I saw on Netflix a Colin Quinn special where he talks about America. Have you seen that one?
Yeah.
It's like a 1 hour, one man show where he's trying to address exactly this problem.
Yeah. I think Seinfeld directed it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Helped him with it.
I thought that was pretty good.
Yeah, I'd like the parts of that. I'm not a big Colin Quinn fan, but I appreciate these things on.
Yeah, I was impressed. At one point, he goes through each state. Yeah, he has says something about each of the 50 states. And I thought that was impressive, just that he could remember all of that. You know, but yeah, I agree. I was never a fan, but having Netflix here completely changed my life in terms of watching TV. So I watch a lot of Netflix. Dave Chappelle is my favorite comedian to see on Netflix. But
yeah, when Chappelle's working, when he's trying, you know, when he's not too high, when he's not, you know, too rich, when he's actually using all of his skills, he's amazing. He's, you know, he's also way past it and doesn't really care half the time. Like, he got paid $60 million to do 3 Netflix specials, and the last one is him sitting on a stool at the Comedy Store, just riffing with the audience for $20 million.
That's crazy. is that comparable to what you get when you do comedy? Are you getting 20 million?
Well, you know, back in the day, I started at 20 million. I'm working my way back.
I wondered how you afforded that microphone I see there.
You know, this microphone has a great story behind it. My partner on the, in my marketing agency, his dad is a legend in the audio business. He invented the syncopated laser light.
Wow.
He was the original sound and light guy for Led Zeppelin.
Wow.
That's a lot of that stuff you see, he owns patents for, because he designed it all at the very beginning.
Wow, that's great.
So he, when we do audio stuff, by God, he's like, yeah, this is the mic I put on John Bonham's drum. So that's the, the one you should get. And I'm like, I'm going to take your advice. So
that's amazing. Can you hear me, by the way? I'm just talking to my normal computer, the microphone embedded in my computer. So the quality.
No, you sound fine. Like the only problem I ever have on Zoom has lowered people's bar for production. They now understand that not everything is produced on TV. And so they've lowered their bar for audio and video. So it's not bad. And you actually sound good. The only problem I ever really run into is if somebody's internet is wonky and they cut out. But yeah, we could improve it, but I sound great. That's all I know. And you sound, passable. So, well, this has been fun, man. I really appreciate you taking the time to catch up and let me know all about Macau.
My pleasure. Yeah. It's good to see you after all these years and find out what's going on. And I'm glad to see you producing all this content and doing something new with a podcast. I've been listening or watching a lot of podcasts on YouTube as well lately. So I like how you connected the academics and politics and everything.
It's a goulash. It's a stew. I'll find something interesting in here. I the more I do it, the more I see like, oh, this would be a fun way of doing this. Like, I don't know if you know what Clubhouse is, the social media app?
No.
You got to check it out. It's kind of the newest social media thing. And it's basically just like panels of people talking and you can go in and listen to their conversation. And they can pull you up on stage to talk, but they don't have to. So Elon Musk kind of has gotten behind it. So 5,000 people will show up to listen to Elon Musk talk about something in a panel. So there's three or four people. And it's really literally just like going to an academic panel and listening to him talk. And when it's done right, it's kind of interesting. And I did one of those this morning. It'd be interesting to see where that goes because it's the same criteria. Can you be interesting while you talk, because people can, just swipe you away.
Right.
And audio with, no decent content is the worst experience ever.
And you had 5,000 people listening to you?
I think I had 60 people that I, have no idea who they are, but they just showed up. It wasn't my room. Like you can sponsor your own rooms, but I haven't done it yet. But so it's, and they're flying in from Saudi, they're just coming from everywhere. It's that kind of interpenetrated social app.
Interesting. I pretty much only use Facebook. I'm not pushing the boundaries on social media apps, but I need to see what new is out there. What was it called again? Showtime? Clubhouse.
Yeah. TikTok is probably your generation. I mean, that's what
I know, kids, of TikTok. Yeah.
TikTok, and they still YouTube, they still graze, through all these things. But I like the long form stuff, and I'll start doing shorter things to try to put kind of bait into the world so that you can draw people into your social media herd and then eventually sell them something. I think it's about, you have to give them about a year of free content before they give you $9. From what I've seen in the marketing space.
You look kind of like Joe Rogan, so you might be able to capitalize off that.
Well, he lives here in Austin now, so he's starting to go to that. There's a comedy club that reopened here, and a buddy of mine runs it, so he's been down there a couple of times. And I've met Rogan, but he wouldn't remember me, so maybe I'll, ease my way over in there.
I bet if you wrestled him or something, you would get some views.
I think he'd probably kick my ass. That guy works out too much. I work out, but not like that. Well, cool, man. I'll circle back around and we'll try to stay in better touch.
Great. Let's do it. Thanks for your interest in talking to me.
Yeah, I totally appreciate it. And, fascinating. At least I'm interested in it. Anything you want to tell people about Macau, or you want to sell anything or promote anything?
I have a book coming out about Macau that I don't know when it'll be out, maybe a year from now. Tentatively called Baccarat City, casino capitalism in Macau. So you look for that. That'll be my statement about Macau and its gaming industry and its history and everything that I've been thinking about for the last 20 years.
Well, so, cool. Yeah, pre-order. That's going to be flying off the shelves like all books.
I'll probably retire off the proceeds I'll make from that.
Yeah, but again, I love academics. I love it when people dig deep into that stuff. And I'm sure there's going to be stuff in that book that, you know, no human being other than you has probably thought about.
Exactly. And nobody wants to think about. You know, I published another book, an edited book, just to give you a sense of the how lucrative this profession is. Several years ago, and every year, the publisher, which is Amsterdam University Press, they send me a very nice form that shows that I have my profits for this year are 0.00. I have, for 3 years in a row, I've gotten a very formal statement that you get nothing. 0.00 profits for Tim this year from his book.
Poor academics. It's so fair. Like I used to get residual checks from writing, you know, for people like Tom Arnold. I would get suddenly, you know, here's $3,700 in the, you know, mail for something I forgot I actually did. And yeah, LA, they have figured out how to make money with content, and there's just such a beautiful system. So, well, cool, man. I'll circle back around. We will stay in touch. Everybody, thanks for listening to the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. Head over to rhetoricwarriors.com. Take a persuasion course, because as we know, persuasion just changes everything. It makes life absolutely perfect. So take a course, and we'll come back some other time and talk to Dr. Tim Simpson a little bit more.
Thanks. Hey, Tim. Bye, Dan.
Thanks, man.